You're the god of this city. You're the king of these people. You're the lord of this nation. You are. You're the light in this darkness. You're the hope.
Thank you for joining us this morning here at Your Family Matters with Carla Dedessi at 1180 WFYL, Working for Your Liberty. Over the last year that I've been blessed to have this show, we have brought the issue of Common Core to the forefront. We have enlightened people and made them aware, introduced them to the federal government coming in to our local and state level and mandating what we are teaching our children. Is this right? Is this good for our families? Is this good for our children? The Constitution says that the state has the power to control education locally. So why is the federal government coming in with this Common Core that we're hearing so much about? I'm so thankful to have with me again Susan Buzzin and Dawn Sweeney of Pennsylvanians Against Common Core and also Pennsylvanians Restoring Education. They are pioneers and they are working tirelessly for your children and your families. Listen, they're homeschool moms. They've also been in the public and government-run schools. They're doing an excellent job educating their own children. They're worried about other people's children. So let's all come together and get our finger on the pulse with this issue called Common Core. Susan Buzzin, I'm going to start with you first. Thank you for being here with us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Carl. It's my pleasure.
Susan, tell us, what is Common Core?
Well, Common Core is an initiative that was started to make sure that all students, K through 12, knows certain things in English, language, arts, and mathematics at the end of each grade. The initiative was sponsored by the Council of Chief State School Officers and also the National Governors Association.
Did we vote on this? Did our legislators vote on this big, huge change?
No, they did not.
Okay.
And that's part of the problem, okay, is that Common Core was basically ushered in through the back door of almost every single school district in the United States without the knowledge, frankly, of a lot of the legislators, and especially without the knowledge of the parents.
Okay, and it's coming from the federal government, so we did not vote on this here in Pennsylvania. They just mandated that this is what we must do. And who created this new standard and this new curriculum? Was it teachers that have been teaching children for the last 30 years?
Well, as much as they like to say that there were educators that were involved in the creation of the new standards, that is not altogether true. There were some educators on the panel, many of whom are very well known, nationally lauded as excellent educators, who, after the standards were written, actually did not put their stamp of approval on them because they felt that they were substandard or that they were developmentally inappropriate. That is very concerning to us, and we feel that there are a lot of other players in the Common Core standards, and that is a lot of politicians. And might I add, both Republicans and Democrats are in on this together. And
what do
also,
they have to gain? Money?
They have a lot of money to gain. They have a lot of power, and they have a lot of money that they have that can be contributed to their campaigns if they support these initiatives. And keep in mind that the people who are going to make the most money from Common Core are the test makers, are the publishers who are coming out with all of the information, all of the standards that the kids are going to be required to follow.
Has this been tested? Any of these new curriculums, these new standards, has the federal government taken the time to test these things?
They have not. And that is exactly
another reason.
That's
also a huge red flag to me as a parent and as a citizen.
Huge red flag. Because normally, in the past, you would have more field studies. You would have a lot more expert educators getting together and trying to figure out exactly, like what I said, what is developmentally appropriate for kids, what standards at the least need to be met by all of these kids across the nation, just so that they can grow up and become productive citizens and decide what they want to do with their lives. But now we really feel like with the introduction of Common Core standards, what we're finding is that it really is setting kids back. It's very confusing. It's, again, not approved by those who should be doing the approvals in the education sector. And it's very concerning, Carla. It really is.
It is concerning. And in my personal experience, you know that I have one that has been mainstreamed into government school, and I have two who I am still homeschooling, and everybody started out being homeschooled. Mm-hmm. And I am a product of government school, and I enjoyed it. I don't have anything against government-run schools and teachers. But I do have an issue and a problem when they are bringing something in that is not tested, when things are going well at my daughter's school presently, and now I'm hearing lots of parents say, "Ugh, my children are crying when they come home with the new math and how they're learning." Parents seem to be frustrated by this. Children seem to be frustrated by this new curriculum, even though I know they're saying that it's not a curriculum. They're doing something new. And teachers also are complaining about this, and even principals. So if everyone's complaining about it, I'm just confused at why these teachers are being mandated to use. Though I think you answered the question a little bit, Susan, that higher ups are getting paid. They have to do this. They don't have a choice. Let me ask you both this question. If we all have government-run schools where the children are doing quite well, 80% are going on to higher education, they are doing well on all of their tests, why must we have a change?
Well,
isn't it a waste of time to train all the teachers? Isn't it a waste of time on having to buy all the new books? I mean, if we're already doing things with excellence, I can see if you want to bring a new standard, a new curriculum into Philadelphia. They're bankrupting our state, the Philadelphia school system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl, I'll jump in and talk about that. Maybe Don would like to add something. But that's exactly what the line is that is being fed to America. We are being compared to other countries, such as Finland, such as China, you know, all of these countries which have a very homogenous student population. And they're saying, well, we're giving our kids these tests, we're not doing well, and therefore we need to find a way to make our students college and career ready. But what they're leaving out is the fact that as people in the United States, we do have a very diverse student body. We don't separate our children from the early age of even, say, third grade like they would do in China and track them to be the cream of the crop or somebody who's always going to be a factory worker, for instance, okay? So when they talk about bringing everybody up to the same standard, they are making a huge mistake in that all kids are not going to learn the same way. We all do not fit into the same box, and we have heard so many heartbreaking stories of parents whose kids may just be developing a little bit differently. For instance, you know as well as I know that boys develop a little bit more slowly than girls. This particular thing with the reading, they want everybody to develop the same reading habits all at the same time. And when you hear the heartbreaking stories of parents who have special needs children, unless they are now severely handicapped, a lot of the previous things that they would be able to do through an IEP or through IDEA, for special education kids, they're no longer able to do that. And these kids are being made to take these tests, are being made to take these assessments, and they are not being given the extra help that they would have before because of their particular disability. And we have reports of children who are literally breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard parents
who are getting depressed. We have children very young who are depressed, and this should be the happiest time of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they're anxious. I spoke with a mother from Philadelphia, and her daughter in special ed is literally pulling her hair out in chunks because she is so stressed over these tests.
And we're going to talk to Dawn. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add to that. My school district is a very high-performing school district. And what's happened over the last 4 years is they've had to, their standards are clearly have been lowered, and they have to follow the race to the top waiver and the mandates. And what's happening is this Common Core Race to the Top initiative is making it pretty much impossible for schools to continue performing at the high levels they were if they were high-performing schools, and it's making it impossible for low-performing schools to improve. And the reason that is because now we used to have AYP, Under No Child Left Behind. We currently have School Performance Profile, which is SPP, and this is how our schools get rated.
Wait, say that again, please, Dawn. What are those initials that you just gave to us, how our schools get rated?
No, through No Child Left Behind, which we've had for the past 11 years.
Right.
It was AYP, which stands for Annual Yearly Progress.
Okay.
And that's how schools were rated.
Okay. And when they get rated very high, do they get more money or it's just accolades?
They get more money.
They do. Okay.
Or if they score low, they lose access to money.
Seems like it should be the opposite, doesn't it?
Right.
The poor performing school districts don't get access to money, and those are the school districts that need the money. So you have high performing schools that continue to perform high, and continue to get money. The formula is backward. But what's changed with Race to the Top in Pennsylvania is we now have the School Performance Profile, which was rolled out last year. This is the first year that we had it. And the acronym for that is SPP. With that formula, it makes it nearly impossible. What's going to happen this year, they rolled the SPP out last year, and now this year they rolled out the Common Core PSSA testing, which the PSSAs are the same in name only. There is nothing else the same in the PSSAs because they're fully aligned to the Common Core standards this year. So they're going to be more complicated. They're going to have multiple correct answers, and this is coming from the PDE. They're going to have multiple correct answers, and they have two parts. Many of the questions have two parts. So you respond to part one, fill in the bubble, that's your answer, and then you respond to part two, fill in the bubble, that's your answer. If you get part one wrong, it's much more difficult to get part two correct. So they're really tricking kids, and to me that's not assessing them. But also what's happening is students with IEPs, if you have a sixth grader who's working at a fourth grade level all year and they have accommodations, they're struggling with reading and they're able, teachers are allowed to read to them. Once it gets to the PSSAs, they must take the sixth grade, their grade level, assess a PSSA. So despite the fact that they're at a fourth grade level and doing fourth grade level work all year, and they can't read, they're expected to take the sixth grade PSSA. So I think we all can clearly see how that will go. What's going to happen since SPP was rolled out last year, and this year we have for the first time the Common Core aligned PSSAs, I believe, and in theory this is what will happen, is every single school district in Pennsylvania will perform poorly. And the PDE has indicated, well, of course they're going to perform more poorly than they did in previous years because the tests are more rigorous, et cetera. So it's really going to be an unfair assessment. But there's a sinister thing going on here, and I believe what's happening is they want to say they're creating a problem. All these school districts are going to be performing poorly after we get the scores back from the PSSAs. So they've created a problem, and the government's going to come in and help and say, well, we need to do this and we need to do that. Eventually, down the road, they're going to want to turn all of our schools into charter schools, for-profit schools run by corporations, not by educators.
Which certainly it appears that that's the way, because we didn't even begin talking about Bill Gates is backing this and Microsoft, I think, is backing this. But before you say another word, Dawn,
sure.
I just need to share that you are our opt-out queen and you are our opt-out blogger. So this really is your field of expertise. And when we're talking about opting out, just for our listeners, you know, we get a bad rap, those of us who dislike Common Core, because I want to abolish two fallacies here right now. Number one, this is not a Republican or Tea Party issue.
No.
This is a bipartisan issue. We have Democrats, we have all walks of life that dislike Common Core and dislike the standardized testing that has gotten so out of control. And that's just a fact. That's number one. Number two, the other fallacy that we need to abolish is that we who dislike Common Core like having a standard. We're not saying that you need to abolish standards. You may have to have a standard, but we dislike that every child, no matter whom they are, it's the same exact pigeonholed standard. Correct, girls?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. So we still have to look individually at our children. And so let's get back to the standardized testing that's happening here in our great state of Pennsylvania. We now have our children, Dawn, taking the PSSAs, the Common Core benchmarks, and the Keystones. How much time is used administering these tests? Let's just talk about administering them. Let's not even talk about preparing for them.
Sure. Well, there's kids are mandated to take these tests in third through eighth grade. All of those grades take math and ELA. This year, ELA starts on Monday, and that's a week's worth of testing. The following week is math, and ELA is in three parts. There's three sections to it. Math starts the following week. There's four sections to math. And then the following week after that, and this is just for fourth graders and eighth graders, there's the science. So there's 3 weeks. My school district is doing it over the next 3 weeks, and I believe most are, because then there's the window for makeup. And what happens to the school when our kids are testing is they usually test in the morning. I still have two or three periods, which is 2 or 3 hours of testing in the morning. The rest of the day, I know in my school district, no one gives out homework. So we have 3 weeks of testing, 2 weeks for most, fourth and eighth grade have that extra week with the science, and that's just an extra 2 days. There's two sections. But what goes along with those days and these next 3 weeks is there's no homework. There's a lot of PSSA review, or they're going to watch movies, or they're going to do fun things to stress relievers.
And that is the truth, because that's what my Victoria is doing for the next 3 weeks. And so, I've opted her out of those PSSAs, which means that I feel like the next 3 weeks are really a waste of space and time for her.
It's a waste of time for the test takers because they're not getting instruction, and it's a waste of time for those
who
are opted out.
Yes,
my daughter is going to be helping the art teacher with the upcoming art show, which she's thrilled about. However,
yeah, but that's not why you're sending your child to school.
That's not why we're sending our children to school. So they're all losing instructional time, and I know this past week, once they went back to school after spring break, was 100%. PSSA test prep. My daughter's language arts class was doing science review in language arts. So there is, and I've talked about this on my blog, as much as 35% of the school year in a course, math or language arts, is spent on PSSA test prep. So, well,
okay. So that's a lot of wasted time.
Yeah.
We identify and we understand that.
It's lost instructional time.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny because people always say to me, what do you mean it only takes you the middle of September and you're finished May 1st with homeschooling? Really? And now, of course, we're mm-hmm. mandated that we have to get a certain amount of days in, so we do a ton of field trips.
Yeah.
But my point is this, there's so much wasted time at public and government-run schools.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, because this is so important, we need to talk about the keystones mm-hmm. that many of us have opted our children out. I personally have not opted my Vittoria out of the Keystone. I've opted her out of the Common Core benchmarks, the PSSAs, and anything else that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just share with you as a parent, Dawn, and I need your expertise. The reason that I have not opted her out of the Keystones is because my understanding is that she has to pass all three of those Keystone exams before she graduates. Now, she's not graduating until
2019.
Thank you. 19. Thank you. Thank you.
I have an 19. Eighth grader.
Yes. Yeah. But, and I truly believe that they're not even going to be around in 2019. So then these Keystones are really a waste of everybody's time.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I know that what a lot of people are doing is that they believe that they're not going to be around in 2019. So they're opting their kids out of the Keystones. And they have the plan that if the Keystones are around in 2019, I've heard some moms say, listen, we're just going to pull our kids out and homeschool them for the last week of school.
Right.
But my personal experience is that I don't want to do that to Vittoria. I don't want her to not be allowed to walk with her class
right.
and graduate with them. That's just my experience. I'm not saying right. it's right or wrong, but we all have to mm-hmm. make this own decision for ourselves. But getting back to those Keystone tests.
Right.
I have talked to politicians who are Democrats and Republicans,
mm-hmm.
huge Democrat, and who says that the Keystones do not make sense for the children who are doing extremely well or even mediocre. They're passing them like, okay, so what's the point? We already know that they're doing super well because they're just doing well on the tests that they have to take from their teacher, that their teacher's right. providing them with. That shows them enough that they're doing well. Okay. And let's talk about the kids that are going or that are doing poorly in math, whether it's because they have a learning difference mm-hmm. or because they're just not a motivated student. So they're going to do very poorly. They're going to fail the Keystone. And so, Dawn, tell us about, this is really not beneficial to our low performing. It's not beneficial to the high performing. It's not beneficial to the middle. It's also not, it's really going to be hurtful to the lower performing. Because my understanding, Dawn, is that if they do not pass the Keystone, they have to do a 30-hour project
right.
that's just all math, math.
Project-based assessment.
Right.
So I can tell you a couple things. I also have a 10th grader. She's in the class of 2017, which is the first class that falls under the graduation requirement. I have opted her out of the Keystone exams. She's set to take the biology and literature this May. The reason I opted her out, she's a 3.8 GPA. She's in honors classes. I opted her out of the test prep. If you don't pass the Keystone exams, and just to give you a statistic, the last year for 2014, the Keystone exams, there are three of them, and on average, 40% of students statewide passed. So,
40% pass statewide?
Yes.
Okay. So that means 60% of them, we have to do something alternative with them.
Right. And I'll explain that. For example, the Algebra 1, spring 2014, 40.1% of students scored proficient or advanced. That means 60% of the students did not pass. And what it means for those students, and I can tell you there was 203,000 students who were tested, 82,000 passed. 122 students did not pass. 122,000 students did not pass statewide. What happens to these, and this is 60%, of the students statewide in Pennsylvania, they are mandated to take a remedial math class.
Right. So let's just talk about that for 1 minute. You have a child that dislikes math, is doing very poorly in math. And what do we think is the...
You have a child who took Algebra 1. And I've talked to many parents whose kids have passed Algebra with A's and B's.
Oh, but they just cannot pass the test.
And they did not pass the Keystone exam. All of these students have taken Algebra 1.
See, because it doesn't even make sense to me, like, to just make a kid, let's say that, okay, so I hear what you're saying, Dawn, but for the other children that dislike math or are never going to pass this because it's not their strength, why are we going to make them sit through a torturous class that they dislike?
Well, right. You're first of all, and the way this affects all students is you miss out on an elective. So, like, my daughter wanted to take her elective last year was journalism. So, and, you know, there's videography, there's animal studies, all sorts of electives. Students are being pulled out of elective classes to take this remedial math class for a class that they already took and for a class that most have already passed. And the issue that I have, if you got an A, B, or C, even a D in Algebra 1, you took the class for a full year and
you should be able
and
to
you
opt
passed
out.
It. Let's move on to the next class. Now, what is happening? And I called my superintendent in this. Students are being pulled out of electives to take this mandatory remedial class. So you have students who are now in geometry and taking a remedial algebra class. You have students in the class of 2015 and 2016 who are taking calculus and a remedial algebra class because they've taken the test 2, 3, and 4 times and have not passed it. And these students in the class of 2015 and 2016 are not offered the PBA. And the point I want to make with this is these students can opt out. School districts are telling them that they can't, that they've made it a graduation requirement to pass all 3 keystones, which is fine. A school district can do that. However, the school district does not have the authority to override state law. And they can opt out.
So tell us how we opt out.
It's a very simple process. You send your principal an email, a letter, a phone call. I would recommend an email because you can confirm that you sent it. And just say, I'm requesting to have my child opted out of the Keystone exams. And this is the same process for the PSSAs. Send an email to your principal and or superintendent. They'll contact you. And it won't be until the spring that they contact you. The last 2-3 weeks, we've been opting out of PSSAs. So within about 2 weeks of the testing administration, you'll get a call back from your school to schedule time to review the test. And the reason it's a 2 or 3 week window is because the schools don't have the test until then. So parents would need to come in, review the test, and sign a confidentiality agreement that states they're not going to share the information that's on the test. What I did when I reviewed the PSSAs for my daughters, I had a letter pre-written that stated, on this date, I reviewed the PSSAs, and I'm opting my child out for religious beliefs. And I handed it to the principal on Tuesday. I went to review, and I just handed it to him at the time of the review. And that's it. And this cannot be denied. The only reason we're allowed to opt out in Pennsylvania is for religious beliefs. And I just want to make it clear that parents do not need to be specific about their religious beliefs. And that's important because the Pennsylvania Department of Education has given out misinformation to school districts, and it's statewide. We're getting concerns from parents statewide that their school districts are asking them to specifically state what religious beliefs are in conflict with the testing, and also to go through the PSSA or the Keystone and state what content in the test is in conflict with your religious beliefs. That's illegal. It's not required by the law. This was coming from the Pennsylvania Department of Education, this misinformation. So parents need to know that they do not need to be specific on their religious beliefs. They simply say, I'm opting out for religious beliefs, and that's it.
And may I jump in and add something to that?
great explanation on how to do it from Don. In the beginning, when you do go to sign, when you do go to review the test, you have to sign a confidentiality agreement, which says you will not disclose any part of the test to anyone. That includes school administrators. That includes to any other parents. It just means you cannot disclose it to anybody. So the reality is that when these school districts are asking for specific parts of the test with which they disagree, they are essentially encouraging them to break the confidentiality agreement that they had to sign, therefore putting them in legal jeopardy.
So thank you both for joining us today. I'm going to finish with this. This is something that I wrote for Pennsylvania's Restoring Education. 5 surefire ways to make sure your child hates education. And then in parentheses, and parents and teachers too. We start with number 5, girls. Ready, set, read. Manuals. Giving children manuals to read on things like how to install a dishwasher versus reading Greek mythology adventures is the best way to kill their love of reading. Definitely do not let your children read Huckleberry Finn and other classics. Reading the classics will only create an appetite for more reading. They may even be asking you to go to the library. 4, introduce your child to lattice math. This will decrease their love for math by teaching them high-level abstract techniques for computations beginning in kindergarten. We love that it takes 2 to 3 times longer to do simple math with this untested approach. Definitely do not teach them to line numbers in the ones, tens, hundreds columns, as this is old and we love new approaches, which we use on guinea pigs. Ooh, I mean your children. Warning, do not do any rote memory in the grammar years. We do not want children memorizing math facts, which will allow them to compute higher math more quickly. 3, grammar, spelling, cursive writing? Who needs it? We are texting these days. JS, 2QT, LOL, BRB, TTYL. 2, keep preaching the importance of Common Core standards. Insist no new curriculum is needed, even though teachers must be trained in Common Core use and we need Common Core approved textbooks. Just continue using Common Core's unhelpful and experimental teaching methods with every student. All students are the same. There's no uniqueness to our learning styles. One size really does fit all. Number 1, if the first 4 do not kill your child's and your parents' and your teacher's love for learning, this is the surefire way to make sure your child hates education. Make your child take standardized tests for hours, days, even weeks. Definitely do not opt out of these standardized tests. To do field trips, supplemental reading of the classics, definitely do not teach the archaic 3 R's during standardized testing. Bonus, parents hate standardized testing as we are collecting data on their children starting in kindergarten. Just play dumb if they ask questions about this section. So that's what I wrote for you all for Pennsylvania's Restoring Education for
Us. That's amazing, Carla, and really that does sum a lot of this up very, very well. And before we leave, I'd like to encourage people to visit us at www.pennsylvanianrestoringeducation.org and check out our Facebook page, Pennsylvanians Against Common Core. We have a lot of resources. We have a lot of instructions regarding opting out and what's going on currently in the educational landscape. And we have a lot of people who are there to answer parents' questions and help people through this process.
Thank you so much. And I want to encourage parents that parents are the ones that should have control over their children's education. I know that we're busy today. Parents are super busy, but we do not want to give that right over to our federal government, which is what is happening with Common Core. Do you have any final thoughts, Dawn?
I just want parents to know that it's 100% legal to opt out. And
what's your website?
optoutpa@blogspot.com.
Thank you so much, girls, for all that you're doing, and please continue to work tirelessly to help all of our kids in Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you for joining us here at Your Family Matters, 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. We have author Joanne Durgan with us today. Joanne, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. Happy
thank you
Friday.
For being patient. We are having a very exciting day here in the station, and I just thank you for your patience.
Certainly. I enjoyed listening to what you were just discussing.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Joanne, tell us about the books that currently you have finished writing and just went up on Amazon.
Well, I was very industrious during the month of March. I released on March the 5th, I released a book that's the first in my Wondrous Love series, and it's called Love So Amazing. And so the next one, of course, in the series will be Love So Divine, and it'll come out later this year. But this is a shorter novel for me. It's one that I actually got the idea when I was in Indianapolis, Indiana, at a writer's conference a few years ago. And we were staying at the Hilton, but we had a big banquet at the Hyatt. And we came out of the Hyatt after the banquet, and we needed to get back to the Hilton, and we were not going to walk. We had evening gowns and high heels on. And there was a pedicab there. I don't know if you're familiar with pedicabs, or if many of your audience members are familiar with pedicabs, but I certainly didn't know what it was called. Some people call it a rickshaw.
Okay.
As it's explained in the book, it's not a rickshaw. It's usually in Asian countries, and it's a cart, more or less, that passengers sit in, and it's pulled by a person. However, a pedicab is actually a bicycle-operated vehicle, and it's a cart. And so we took a pedicab that night from the Hyatt to the Hilton, and it was wonderful. And I talked to the pedicab owner-operator and got a lot of information. And so I started formulating this idea that someday I'd like to write about that, because it was a profession I had certainly never heard of, and it was different. So you're always looking for something different, of course, when you're an author. So anyway, my husband and I went to Puerto Rico in January, at the end of January, and I didn't take my laptop, and I was determined not to write. I was going to take a break, but authors never seem to.
I'm surprised. I know.
So what? I was on the beach. I was around the pool, and what was I doing? I was writing longhand this story, Love So Amazing. And so when I came home, I was on deadline for another book, but these characters just wouldn't let go. I just had to tell the story. So I wrote it basically in 2.5 to 3 weeks' time, and I edited it, finalized it, and got it up on Amazon. And it has actually been one of my best sellers, because I put it up for 99 cents. And 99-cent books usually go very well. Anyone's willing to try a book pretty much for 99 cents, but it's proven to be a great marketing tool for my other. I have a long-running series, and I have Christmas books. I have quite a number of books now. But Love So Amazing has really been great, and I absolutely love the story.
And you know that I'm a huge fan of all of your writing.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, this is a dance instructor, Ava, and the pedicab operator-owner is Sawyer Mancini.
So you're introducing new characters, Joanne, the Lewis Legacy series and different from your prelude.
I'm sorry?
Different from your Lewis Legacy series and different from the prelude.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent.
I'm sorry, it's hard to hear you for some reason, but...
So go ahead. So yes, Love So Amazing.
It's entirely different.
Great.
And then I did have another book that just came out March 27th, and it seems like these books in March, though, came out in conjunction or somehow correlated with trips that I took, because I was in Florida trying to finish this book.
Maybe you're relaxed and your juices are flowing.
Could be. I don't know, but this one is Heart's Design. Now, Heart's Design is actually a book that I got the idea for that one when I lived in Philadelphia. And I was a stay-at-home mom for 6 years and had 3 small children. And I remember my husband, actually it was when I had the first child and I was pregnant with the second, before the third was even born, or an idea in my mind. But my husband was a music minister, and he went to Lake Erie Bible Conference, and he was a worship minister for a week. And during that week, I actually wrote this book. So the Heart's Design was originally called Oxford Hills. And I got the idea from the Philadelphia Inquirer. I believe that's still the name of your newspaper there.
Wow, yes, it is.
Yes, I got the idea from the travel section in a Sunday paper once. And the thing is that Oxford Hills, or Oxford County, it's in western Maine. It's the foothills of the White Mountains, a beautiful area of the country in New England. But in this area in Oxford County, and it's a small size area, but in that area, it is the wealthiest area in the entire world, the entire planet, of gemstones and minerals, and just rich in all of these things. And so I had a girl who graduated from Wellesley College from a very, very wealthy Boston family, whose dad has a very prestigious law firm, and he had gone to Harvard Law, and her brothers go to Harvard, and she's expected to follow in the family's footsteps after her graduation and go to Harvard Law. Well, she decides to take a hiking trip, kind of, you know, that's not her. That's not something she normally would do, but she decides just for the fun of it and kind of a fling that she would go on this hiking trip with two of her best friends from Wellesley before she is expected to go to Harvard Law School in the fall. And she falls in love with this little town called Evergreen, Maine, and it's in these foothills. Now, originally the book was called Oxford Hills, but in order to be a romance, it sounded better to call it Heart's Design. But she doesn't really, she wants to go to Harvard Law because she's interested in the law. She wants to fulfill her family's dream. But her secret desire in her heart is that she's always loved designing jewelry. And what better area than to, you know, to go to than this area that is so rich in these natural gems and minerals. And so she meets a guy when she's there. She goes for the weekend on a hiking trip, and they go in the mountains for a few days, and then she finds this little town, and she absolutely falls in love with the people. She falls in love with the environment, everything about it, and she meets a young man who is there that comes to the area frequently, and he's there for a wedding, and he's a mineralogist. Try to say that three times. He's a mineralogist, and he drives a white truck with a license plate that says, "I dig rocks." And he wears flannel
That's what I do
and,
love
I mean,
about
flannel jeans. Yeah. He wears flannel shirts and jeans and hiking shorts half the time, and he loves Jesus. Now, Caroline is not a Christian. This is the first time I've written a book that I, to my knowledge, where the girl is not a Christian for half the book. But and basically, her trip to Maine takes half the book, and then it jumps to 2 years in the future. But I do a little backstory to tell you, you know, when she tell the reader about when she told her father that she was not going to finish Harvard Law. She was not going to the law firm. So I fill all that in for the reader. But Seth Barnes is the name of this mineralogist. He's a part-time professor as well at one of the local universities in Maine. But they make that connection when she's there in Maine. And he gives her something very, very special. They don't know if they're going to ever see each other again. He has a girlfriend. And so it was a challenge to, in that book, to number one, make a rich girl sympathetic to readers. That's sometimes hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that she wasn't a Christian for half the book. And then, but it is part of a spiritual journey, is a big part of this book, too. And then number three, to make this book romantic for that first half between Seth and Caroline and form that connection between them so that the reader wants to see them get back together again without them actually being romantic. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, and you are certainly an expert in romance. I would truly say that from reading four or five of your books already. You really do keep your reader from, you know, sometimes we know
That's
what's going
to
happen
hear.
At the end, but I like to see the twists and turns that each relationship takes. And
right.
I just want to applaud you for being able to do that and really establish relationships and dislikes and likes and strengths and weaknesses. And I've told
Thank
you before
you.
That by the end of reading your books, I feel like I want the book to go on for quite a few more chapters because these people are my friends and I'm really interested in what's going to happen next. But
well, I think that's the beauty of the series that I write, because in the series it continues and you get more of these characters, and especially as they're growing their families and going through the years, I think it's nice.
But I also love, I think it's vital, and what I've really find most edifying about your writing and your work is that your novels, your writing is more than just a story. I truly believe that you have a gift of being able to encourage people who are reading your books, encourage them in their faith walk, encourage them in their Christian walk, and that's really a gift, Joanne.
Thank you. And, you know, that's my calling from the Lord. And I feel that He has given me these stories. And knock on wood, so to speak, I have never suffered from writer's block. And I don't know.
Yeah, it's prolific. Prolific writer.
Thank you. I just wish that I didn't need sleep, but I do. But even last night, I stayed up till 3 a.m. this morning.
And
we had a bad thunderstorm. We did have a bad thunderstorm, but that's not why I was up. But I was up, and then I went to bed about 4, and I still couldn't sleep. So I finally just got up about 6, and I said, forget it. And I was going to lay down about 9, and I thought, if I lay down, I might miss this interview.
Well, thank you, Joanne. Joanne, so we've talked so much about Joanne, the author. I want to talk about Joanne, the mom, and recently, Joanne, the grandmother. How's your baby, your granddaughter? And has she been an inspiration in any characters or thinking about future books?
Well, she will in future books, I'm sure. And I have several children now in my series, especially. And her name is Amelia Grace. And I actually have a girl in my series. Her name is, she goes by Amy, but her name is actually Amelia. But
I read that
it's
one.
Funny. But it's funny because my daughter did not even realize that my Amy in my series was actually named Amelia. I think she named her, she not didn't name her after, but her inspiration was some character on Doctor Who. So.
Oh, that's funny. And you do you bring a lot of humor into your books too.
I try to. But
How much time does it take you to research? Like, for example, the book that I just finished reading, Prelude, researching what was happening in the 1950s, 1960s, and now this book, Love So Amazing, which you're talking about this geological place where all these rocks are.
Oh, that's Heart's Design. That's the petty cab.
Heart's Design.
The one in Love So Amazing, but Heart's Design. Well, I got a lot of information on Heart's Design about the gems and the minerals. I got a lot of it from that article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And then the wonders of the Internet never cease to amaze me, because I don't know what authors did before the Internet, because it's just fabulous to be able to input anything you want and pretty much get this, a wealth of information at your fingertips.
So what advice would you give to somebody who wants to be an author?
To write. That's basically the way you learn, because I have a journalism and English degree, and that taught me the mechanics of writing. But until you actually sit down and try to write fiction, it's an entirely different ballgame. And as far as the research that you ask about, I love doing the research. Now, Prelude, that you just finished, was actually considered historical fiction. It's set in 1962, and I was alive then. I was a young one, but I had a blast doing the research, because I got to research the songs and the clothing styles. I had a lot of fun with, you know, and the cars, and it was a blast. And I have a book coming up in the series, as I mentioned to you before, about an astronaut. And let me tell you, I did a lot of research on that one, but the Lord brings people into my life that really can help me with these things, because I worked at the Kentucky Center for the Arts part-time when I was writing that book a few years ago. All these books are written in a series. I'm just revising them and editing them and basically rewriting them now, but the Germany idea is there. But anyway, I worked at the Kentucky Center for the Arts and knew a girl who was from Houston who had friends who worked at NASA who were working on the Mars project. She put me in contact with them. They answered every question I had about a shuttle commander and about going to the International Space Station. And then I went to Houston and toured NASA, or Houston Johnson Space Center, and it was amazing. So I pour a lot of work and time into my research, but to me it's fun. It's not work. It's just part of what's going to make my book more accurate and more fun for the readers. And as far as an astronaut, I don't have to get too technical, but it has to be right. But that book has my heart, too, and I tell you, it has some exciting moments, and that, Carla, is the book that should be the movie.
I know. I'm waiting. These are going to be on Hallmark or the Lifetime Movie Channel, I'm telling you.
Well, I hope so. I keep getting those comments, and so if Hallmark would maybe hear that, I think a lot of my books would lend themselves to this. And actually, Love So Amazing, the one about the pedicab operator in Indianapolis, set in Indianapolis, because that's where I got the idea for it. It is dedicated to my granddaughter, you had mentioned, and so she had a book dedicated to her when she was about 3 weeks old.
Aww,
so how about that?
That's such a gift. That's such a gift. So tell us, how can we connect with you?
Well, you can find me on Facebook. That's probably where I'm usually at.
At Joanne Durgan?
Just Joanne Durgan is my personal page. It's J-O, capital A-N-N, and then Durgan, D-U-R-G-I-N.
Do you have book pages?
And then I also have author Joanne Durgan, A-U-T-H-O-R. I can't talk to my, sorry. Author Joanne Durgan is my author page on Facebook. And then my website is www.joannedurgan.com. And readers can always send me a message through my website, and many do. And, you know, it's a good problem to have, Carla, but I've had a hard time keeping up with my website because I've had so many books, and I'm actually part of two box sets, too, where other authors and I go together, and for 99 cents, you can get a lot of novels.
So exciting.
And it's like a sampler of different authors, but it's actually full-length novels. We had Love Brings Us Home, which is still going strong, and My Awakening, which is the first book in the series that you've mentioned, Lewis Legacy series of my debut novel. That is in Love Brings Us Home. They can go to my page on Amazon. My books are exclusive to Amazon, by the way, right now, except for some are on Barnes & Noble, but most of them are exclusive to Amazon now. But there are still a few that are on Barnes & Noble.
And I want my listeners to understand that you are a very experienced author and that you have been writing for over 20 years.
I've been writing that long, but I've only, my first book was published in November of 2010. But as I mentioned, I had written Oxford Hills, which is now Heart's Design, the one set in Maine. I wrote that, I want to say, see, Sarah was born in 1989. Yes, 89. So, you know, since about that time. So however many years that is, I'm not a mathematician and I haven't had much sleep. So,
and your books, Joanne, are printed but also available as e-books.
Most of them are in print, yes. Love So Amazing, the 99-cent book, is simply going to be e-book.
Okay. That is the wave of the future, I think.
It is. But you know what? What I love about Amazon, too, is that, and Amazon doesn't pay me to say any of this, but they've been loyal to me, so I'm loyal to them. But Amazon has a feature where if readers don't have an e-book reader, they can download a book to their computer. And if they don't mind, they can read a little bit at a time or how much as they want, but they can read it at their computer. So you don't have to have an e-reader. But most of my, all of my series books are in print. Prelude's in print. Catching Serenity, which I know you read. That's a good summer book to read. It's, you know, has a bit of a mystery in it.
It is. I recommend all of your books for summer reads. They are just great beach reads, you know.
Thank you. And Heart's Design will be in print. We're actually working on that now. And I absolutely love the cover for Heart's Design. I think it came out. It has there's a bed and breakfast that's actually a character in itself up in Maine in that book. And because I think that houses and cars and, you know, I seem to bring them to life. They just have a personality on and so that house is featured on the bed and breakfast, and it's a beautiful old New England home. And so that's been a big draw on that cover, too. It looks appealing. It just looks appealing.
Well, I can't wait for these other books to come out. And this evening, I'm going to definitely get my 99-cent books that you have out presently. I always
check
and see what you have going on. And I want to thank you also personally for being a mentor to me a little bit with my writing of my Julia Learns children's book series. I remember
you... Oh, they're fabulous books. They're fabulous. And thank you. I hope I was able to help you in some way.
Yes. I remember you saying to me, you just have to continue writing. You know, it mm-hmm. might be finally that fifth book is what explodes. Because for you, how many books have you sold on Amazon now? I mean, we're in the...
As far as the number of books or the
altogether,
number of copies I've actually sold.
No, the actual copies of books that have been sold. Isn't it like 50,000 or more?
Oh, it would be more, and I've actually given away a lot free, too. And that's a way that I actually have sold the series. For instance, a month ago, I gave away about 28,000 copies in 2 days of Twin Hearts, which is the third book in the series. But
so it's just so exciting that you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people reading your work.
Right. And by offering the third book free, though, it sold the other books in the series. I also have a four-book set for $9.99, which is the first four books in the series. And that's been a good seller for me, too. But, you know, I'm not an author that sits and looks at my numbers all day, and I don't. I do look at them, of course, but I'm just not focused on that. I'm just focused on writing the next book, and that's what I need to do. And the more books you have, the more you sell, you know, and they've caught on, and the Lord has blessed me immeasurably. And I do believe that he's blessed me with a certain amount of talent, and I'm just going to use it to the best of my ability, Carla. So that's what I try to do. And, yes, just keep writing. You had asked that question, too, about what to advise authors, and that's what I told you, that the best way to learn, the best way to grow as an author is to read. You need to read other works as well. I read the classics. I started out with, you know, Nancy Drew. I love Nancy Drew books. And then I read the classics and read everything I could get my hands
Joanne.
On. Joanne?
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I want to encourage everybody to go to joannedurgan.com and check out her work.